Okay, if you weren't here last week, we began a little series looking at emotions in the Christian life. And specifically last week, we spent most of our time looking at Jesus and seeing how, as the perfect man, he had strong emotional reactions to different events, different situations, different people sometimes. And we were just trying to lay a foundation that emotions, far from being a sort of dangerous thing that we're meant to slightly shy away from, are actually part of what it means to be fully human. God has made us to be emotional. Now, clearly, there are dangers with emotions too. There are ways that emotions can get out of hand. But part of becoming Christ-like means growing in our emotions. Not necessarily for all of us getting more emotional. For some of us, it might mean that. Some of us, you know, we might be like logic machines and we need to get our heart somewhat more in balance with our head. But the point more is that, if you like, our emotions and Jesus's ought to match up more closely. Just as we're meant to think like Jesus thinks, we're meant to love like Jesus loves, we're meant to act like Jesus acts, serve like Jesus serves, well, so our emotions ought to be in line with Jesus's. What we're going to look at today, really, is I suppose, sort of the next step on, and that is the role of the heart in a Christian's emotional life. I'm going to start by just trying to explain a little bit about what the Bible says about the heart, and then we'll, as normal, we'll do some discussion around the tables. So the first thing I put down there is that you've got to understand, when we come to talk about the heart in the Bible, that the way the Bible uses the word heart and the way that we tend to use the heart nowadays are different. I put down Bible versus Clinton's cards. The way we use the word heart nowadays is a sort of gushy, emotional, lovey centre, isn't it? You know, my heart is yours forever. You know, my heart will go on, or whatever that song was on Titanic. It means sort of lovey-dovey and all emotional. In the Bible, the word heart is not often linked to emotion, or at least not just linked to emotion. In the Bible, your heart is your control centre, if you like. I remember when I was little, I used to go and stay at my gran's house, and it was a bit boring because she didn't have any toys, and there was nothing to do really. It was up north and it was grim, up in sort of Clare and Reuben territory. The only thing she had was this sort of annual, comic annual from when she was little, and there was characters in it. Hey guys, characters in it called the Nerds. I don't know if they're still going, but the Nerds were little people who lived inside you and controlled you. And there was a whole cartoon about this little sort of group of mini people who were pulling levers to make your arms work and, you know, pressing buttons to make you cry and all the rest of it. Your heart is the sort of command centre of you. Okay, it's where the little Nerds work, making you do all sorts of things. So on the sheet there, Proverbs 4 verse 23, which is one of our memory verses, although this is from the NIV rather than the ESV. Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Who knows the ESV? Memory verses? It is the wellspring of life. Very good, Lucy. Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Everything flows out of it. And it's a classic Bible verse, really, on this idea that the heart is the controller of the sort of real you. So, for example, let's have a look at Matthew 12. I mean, we could have gone all over the place for this. It's something like 850 references to the heart in the Bible, which I thought would be a little bit excessive for one night. So, Matthew 12. Sam, can you read Matthew 12, 33 and 34? Okay, Jesus preaching, and particularly dealing with people who are rejecting him at the time. Look at the last sentence there. Out of the abundance or the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Again, it's the same picture as the Proverbs one, as the heart almost like a fountain. What's in your heart controls what you say. It just sort of bubbles over. So when you insult someone, that's not exactly a sin of the tongue. It's a sin of the heart. You insult them because your heart hates them, dislikes them. When you gossip, it's not a sin of the tongue, it's a sin of the heart. You're gossiping because, well, perhaps because you want to show that you're on the inside rather than on the outside, or you've got a little juicy tidbit that's going to make someone else look foolish and you look good in comparison. The heart, says Jesus, controls what you say. It's an interesting verse on evangelism, actually. We're very, you know, if you won the lottery, or you had a great weekend, a great holiday, your heart enjoys that, and so you speak about it very naturally. Do I sort of naturally overflow talking about Jesus, about what he's done for me? Well, not so much. What's the problem? Not a problem with my mouth, it's a problem with my heart. I don't treasure Jesus as much as I should do. So the heart controls what we say, but it also controls what we do. I think that's the idea of the picture of the fruit tree, or the tree. Make the tree good, its fruit will be good. Make the tree bad, its fruit will be bad. You can't make a tree into a good tree just by putting on good fruit. It's not going to change anything. If you sellotape some apples from Morrison's onto a dead apple tree, it's not going to make any difference. Apples have to be connected to the source, the wellspring, the heart. And I suppose in the same way, I think what Jesus is trying to say is your fruit, i.e. what you do, is a giveaway of what you actually love, what you cherish, what your heart clings to. An apple tree will grow apples, a pear tree will grow pears. A heart that loves Jesus and the gospel will grow the fruit of the Spirit. A heart that loves money will grow actions that grow money, sadly not grow money, but will grow a greedy person. It'll grow someone who covets, it'll grow someone who envies, it'll grow someone who hoards, whatever it might be. So the heart controls what we say, it controls what we do, it basically controls everything. It's the control center. So when you come across the word heart, don't think primarily emotions, think the real me, the inner me. But how does it work? Let's just flick on to Romans. And Paul gives some really important principles for understanding how our hearts work nowadays. Let's read 18 to 25. Tim, are you okay for?
For I am not sorry, 18. For yeah. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. But what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen.
Thanks. It's arguably, well, it's certainly one of the most important passages for understanding human beings in the whole Bible. We've come to it a few times on Wednesdays. I won't pick through all of it. The basic argument is that God has made himself clear, so everyone knows there's a God. Doesn't matter whether you're an atheist or a Christian or a Sikh or a Hindu, everybody knows in deep down knows the real God. That's got to be true, hasn't it? Otherwise we wouldn't be guilty for not believing in him. We'd just be ignorant. In the same way as, I don't know what the capital of Mozambique is. I'm not guilty for that. It's just something I don't know. if God had sort of hidden himself, well, it wouldn't be anyone's fault they didn't believe. But no, God's made himself clear. We all know it, but what goes wrong? Verse 21, although they, that just means all of humanity, including you and me, they knew God, they did not honour him as God, nor give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. See in that verse 21, end of 21, you become foolish in your thinking, and your foolish hearts are darkened. Your heart in that verse, they're sort of parallel phrases almost, that your heart is almost how you think. Okay, we might use your brains, you know, your foolish brain was darkened. But again, because it's the real you, the center of you, Paul uses the word heart. And what he's saying is, whereas we know, if we were sort of pure and if completely logical and not corrupted by sin, we know God is real, we know he's worthy of thanks and praise, actually, we've become ill, if you like. We've darkened our hearts, darkened our minds, and are now fools. What's the result? Well, the second use of heart, in verse 24 and 25. Because we turn away from God and turn to other images, therefore God gives us up to the lusts of our hearts, to impurity, to dishonouring of our bodies among each other. Why? Well, because human beings exchange the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. In verse 24, your heart is desiring lusts of the heart. It's not talking just about sexual morality, although that's part of it. Your heart wants things. It's sort of ego, it's grasping. And what that leads to, with your mind darkened, the thinking part of your heart, and your sort of desiring part of your heart, skew with and corrupt to, what that leads to is a going after other gods. Verse 25, you exchange the truth of God for a lie and worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. Every human being worships someone. Everyone's heart has to worship. There's no exceptions. Doesn't matter if you say you're an atheist or not. Doesn't matter if you're not religious. Everybody's heart desires something, wants something. It makes you reach out for something and serve something. So in the Bible, therefore, the heart is the centre of the worshipping you. And it's interesting that Paul uses knowledge and desire as two sides of the same coin. If you knew the truth properly, your heart would also desire the truth. If you really knew God, you would desire him. Or to flip it over, if you really desired God, you would have clear thinking about him at the same time. And again, it's this point that comes time and time again in the Bible that our problem is not intellectual, really. Yeah, there are parts of the Bible that are hard to understand. Of course, there are tricky corners here and there. But basically, our problem is moral. Okay, we don't want God. Now, that's why someone's not a Christian. It's not because they can't work through the arguments about does God exist, or they're too put off by science versus religion or whatever. It's because they don't want him. It's a moral problem, not an ethical problem. Sorry, not an intellectual problem. And the flip side of that is, when I become a worshipper of God, when I become a Christian, it's not just about having correct knowledge in my head. As long as I can understand the truth, everything's fine. No, just as I'm meant to think clearly about God, I'm meant to desire him. Okay, I'm meant to sort of almost lust after God, if I could put it that way. You can't have one without the other. I put light and heat on the sheet. The Puritans used to talk about light meaning knowledge and heat meaning passion, for want of another word. And they would bang on and on about the fact that you can't have one without the other. If you've just got light, you've got the best theology in the world, but there's no heat, there's no fire, then you haven't really got knowledge, and vice versa. So the heart desires. It grabs for something. It's always pushing you to worship, to serve, to reach for something else. So what? What's all this got to do with emotions? I said last week that lots of this early stuff is stolen from a book, Graham Biner on the Emotions, well worth getting hold of and reading. He says this. The big issue is this. It's not so much what we feel as why we feel it. emotions aren't wrong in themselves. Even negative emotions like frustration or anger are often perfectly appropriate. What makes emotions wrong is when they flow from wrong heart values. Another quote, and then I'll try and explain them a bit more. Augustine, back in the 400s, we don't so much ask whether a pious soul, so a godly person, is angry as why is he angry? Not whether he's sad, but where does his sadness come from? Not whether he's afraid, but what he fears. Because you're built with these desires and you can't get rid of them if you're a human being, anytime what you desire is threatened or taken away from you, it's going to lead to an emotional reaction. That's what Augustine and Bynon are trying to say. And in Bynon's book, he's got this little equation. You can take an event or a situation, you times it by how much your heart values the particular thing, and that ends up in the strength of your feelings. So, an event, I'm sacked, okay? I get sacked from work. Now, if my heart, if my greatest desire in life is to be a success at work, then that is going to lead me to having a massively, massively stressed reaction to being sacked. Okay, I'm either going to be furious or I'm going to be depressed or my emotional reaction is going to be huge because my heart was set on being someone great, being a success at work. Similarly, you could go on and on, couldn't you? You know, if I desperately, desperately want to get married a non-Christian girl comes along, my emotional reaction should be, actually, this is a bit sad. I can't go out with you, but it's a sort of low-level reaction. I've got to do what's right. But if my heart's desire is to be married, then actually, because that desire is so strong, times it by the event, the girl coming along and saying, "Yeah, I'll go out with you," and actually, my emotion's going to be so sort of joyful. Yeah, I just want a girlfriend, that it's going to lead me into sin. The point that they're all trying to make is that actually emotions don't just spring on you. They're not just sort of instant reactions to situations. I mean, some are emotions like surprise or shock, but that's not really what they're worried about. What they're trying to say is, deep down, your emotions are a giveaway to what you really desire, what you really want, what you really, really worship. So if you like, I think I've put on the sheet. Yeah, emotions are evidence. Okay, they're the sort of the fruit of your heart. You can't see what your heart, you can't look inside you and see what your spiritual condition is. But your emotions give you away, sometimes by wrong reactions. So let's say I've done something wrong and a friend takes me aside and rebukes me. Just says, "Look, actually, Johnny, you shouldn't have done that." Now, if I'm a proud person and it matters a lot to me to always be seen in the right, well, I'll get angry. I say, "Well, why am I angry? Just because someone's corrected me. I was wrong after all." Well, I'm angry because I don't never like to be seen as in the wrong. So sometimes a wrong reaction sort of makes me ask, "Well, just a minute, why am I so annoyed about that, so upset, so worried?" A sort of negative emotion. Sometimes emotions are just too strong. You'll know people who've gone through exactly the same circumstances. Two people both get dumped in the same week. And they're both a bit upset. One of them's devastated. And the other one's a bit upset, but fine. Why is it when they've both gone through almost exactly the same experience? Well, it's because one of them has a heart that is massively set on emotional romantic love. And the other one, maybe not so much. So sometimes if my reaction is too strong, it's a giveaway that something has got too important in my heart. And other times, too weak a reaction. So two Christians sit down and they watch the same news report about the latest disaster the aid agencies are going in, there's thousands of starving children. And one Christian sort of looks at it and goes, that's a bit sad. And the other one's massively moved to sort of give and help. Well, perhaps the first one ought to be asking, why am I not moved by that? You hear the same sermon on the need for evangelism, on the need for worldwide mission, and one Christian is hugely sort of impressed by it and struck by it, and sort of instantly thinks, how can I do more? How can I pray? How can I give? How can I go? And the other one, what's the problem? The heart. In that time, you're not cherishing what you ought to cherish. You don't care about what you should care about. So emotions are a giveaway of what we really feel. Now, in case this is all sounding too negative, just before we do a bit of Bible study, just over the top of the other sheet, sorry, the other side of the sheet, this is actually good news rather than bad news. The fact that emotions are a result of what you desire, what your heart worships and wants. It's good news because it means I'm not a hostage to my emotions. Some of you will sort of know that you are emotional people. Either you know there's a particular emotion you struggle with, perhaps anxiety or depression or anger or jealousy. It could be all sorts of different things. What the Bible's saying, I think, is that we're not hostage to those emotions. They can change. It might be slow and it might be a battle, and I'm not saying it's easy. You just sort of flick a switch. Otherwise, we'd all be shiny, happy people. It doesn't work like that. But the good news is that if it's about my heart, and if Jesus can change my heart, which he promises he can do, then actually I'm not just a hostage to feelings. It's not just about chemicals rushing around my body or whatever. So there's hope. And it also means I'm not a hostage to my circumstances. This is what we're going to look at in the Bible study a bit. There are some things in life you just know you can't change, and you have no power over. You can't guarantee you'll marry. You can't guarantee you'll have kids. You can't guarantee you'll get a successful career. Or you can't guarantee health. All sorts of things are outside of our power in reality. And sometimes that really freaks people out, particularly the emotions of fear come in. What if I never ... But again, if the Bible's view of the heart is right, although I can't control the circumstances, there is hope for me not being just crushed by the circumstances. There's a hope for me to be able to rejoice whilst suffering. There's a hope for me to be able to persevere whilst not getting exactly what I want. Emotions, although they are powerful and they're real and they affect us, they are not our masters. Your heart, if you like, is the captain of your emotions, and your heart is not beyond Jesus' reach. And Titus talks about being washed and renewed by the Holy Spirit, and is your heart ultimately that real you that can be changed. Now, just to put some flesh on the bones, we're going to look at a couple of passages. They're quite short, so you could do each of them in your groups. Just on the first passage, Philippians passage, the second question: what would you be tempted to feel if you were in his shoes? Just try to go a bit beyond sad, okay? Just try and think it through a bit more, okay? That will make sense. We've done question one, but have a go at that for sort of, 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll see how we go. Let's come back together. Really, both the passages are illustrations of just some of the principles we've seen so far. Paul, pretty obviously, is in prison because of his preaching of the gospel. How do you feel? Sad, but...
Dave
said sad. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, well done, Dave. Going a bit deeper. How would you be tempted to feel? Was that...
Really sad,
brilliant. The emotional group in the corner. Thought we'd keep you all together. Just give Jay a little tickle and he cheers up. Anyone else? If Paul's been out, he's been preaching the gospel, wandering across the continents, and then he's banged in jail. What's... I'm sure that's what I'd feel. Look, I haven't stayed at home, God. I've gone out and been a missionary. I've been through storms, I've been in danger, I've been bitten by snakes, I've done everything. And I'm in jail, and there's a bunch of other basically idiots on the loose preaching, and they're out there. They're fine. I'd be furious. What sort of payback is this for my, super missionary work?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 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 Yeah, good. Yeah, that's, yeah, interesting. Yeah. More sensitive person might respond that way. Yeah. Hmm. Because it's not. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it'd be a lot better with me out there than these wallies preaching for the false. Hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Stuff this for a bunch of soldiers. Throw my toys out the pram and off we go. Yep. You can see in those sort of circumstances, pretty horrible circumstances, you know, those are the kind of ways that we'd be tempted to react, isn't it? You know, one way or another. Basically, they're all pretty negative. But how does he react? Well, basically, his emotional state, to be slightly simplistic, is he's rejoicing, verse 18. Why? Well, it's back to the heart stuff, isn't it? What he values is Christ's glory. As long as Christ's being preached, I'll rejoice. I can preach it to the guys I'm chained to. And even though there's all sorts of, you know, preachers with bad motives out there, they are preaching the gospel. Christ being glorified, you know what? I'm happy. Because in Paul's heart, the sort of main chamber, if you like, is filled with Christ. So as long as I've got that, great. It's a bit like the verse, you know, we came back to time and time again. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. I kind of don't care. As long as I've got him, fine. It's a really striking example of this equation that Bynum puts together. You know, my heart value, what I really value, is Christ. Or to put it another way, prison is bad, but actually I don't value my own freedom or my own, you know, my own success very much at all. So I don't feel that bad about it. You know, he's not destroyed by it. Because his own glory is just not a big thing. It's not a big thing in Paul's heart. So yeah, I'm sure if you asked him, he said, Paul, look, would you rather be in prison or not in prison? I'd rather not be in prison. You know, would you rather have a good meal or a scroungy prison meal? Well, yeah, of course I'd rather have a proper meal. But they're not really strong heart values, so he's not crushed into negative emotions. And in fact, because Christ is being preached, he's not just surviving, he's flourishing, rejoicing. The Mark passage I put in, just as a bit of a contrast, really. I deliberately put emotional in you know, quotation marks because, you know, don't over-psychologise when we're not specifically told. But it's pretty obvious Jesus is hacked off, isn't it? At what's going on in the temple, that, you know, the made it a den of robbers, a den of thieves, rather than a house of prayer. Where did you get with that last question? What are some of the lessons that story might tell us? Okay, just go on.
We were sort of thinking, well, getting angry is usually all quite bad.
Yeah.
We thought, if I was to get angry, it's almost like not good myself either, so to get angry at somebody else, it's almost a critical thing. You then show the angry, the measure of stick against the Bible, and question that might be wrong there, or sort of comparing you to them.
Yep. Okay. So, in a sense, therefore, So you're just saying the Bible is it's like the safeguard or the check that lets you know whether your emotional response is right or wrong.
Yeah.
The gauge. Yep. Yep. What else have you guys come up with?
I think you probably should.
Probably.
Should, yeah.
Yeah. Gone, like what?
Say, when you hear about
it certainly shows that anger is not always a bad emotion, doesn't it? Jesus obviously isn't sinning. He's right to be this angry, furious, you might even say, by the dishonouring of God. Yeah, and there will be similar circumstances. We're not as pure as Jesus, but just because we're not pure and perfect doesn't mean we should never, ever sort of try and emulate some of those reactions. He's as much a model for us in his righteous indignation as he is in his love and service.
Point two is that his anger didn't come from a selfish heart, but from a God-centered heart.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
And we had it was controlled. So in the Mark passage, Jesus was still teaching. He was very deep out.
Yeah.
And controllable rage.
Yeah.
He was angry, but he was explaining why he was doing what he was doing.
So yeah.
That element, Jesus was controlled.
Yeah. So, absolutely. If Tim and Matt and I whatever start preaching heresy, you should be angry and you should stop us. And actually, that won't be that will be loving. Because if we continue to preach heresy, we are damaging people. So it would be unloving not to get angry. Yeah. So it shows this second passage that being properly emotional like Jesus is not just about being happy, happy, smiley, smiley all the time. It also shows that you can't really divide emotions into a sort of good list and a bad list. It's a bit like the Bynum quote on the page before. The big issue is this: it's not so much what we feel as why. Emotions aren't wrong in themselves. Even negative emotions like frustration or anger are often perfectly appropriate. What makes them right or wrong is when they flow from wrong heart values. So, again, and we'll probably say this again in the next few weeks, please don't hear this stuff on emotions as just a repetition endlessly of rejoice, rejoice, always be happy, always be happy. No, part for lots of us, for most of us maybe, all of us even, one of the things we might have to do off the back of thinking about these things and praying about them is get more angry. I can't remember what he's talking about, unfortunately, but there's a bit in one of John Stott's Bible commentaries where he says the church needs more angry people and the church needs more haters. He's talking one of the passages about, you know, hating sin, obviously, rather than just hating non-Christians or something. But it's quite striking. He needs to be more angry and more full of hate for the things that we're meant to be angry at and hate. I said earlier that actually this stuff is good news because it means we're not victims to our situations, as we've just looked at, or we're not just victims to my emotions or my immediate emotional reactions. I just want to look at a couple of verses, just flesh that out a bit before we go back to the groups for the last section. As we've seen with both these passages, clearly what you're meant to value most is God. Okay, if your heart will treasure God, if your heart will desire God, then you're going to be able to live out the kind of balanced life that we're called to. Psalm 37 and verse 4 is a verse that John Piper has basically built a ministry on. But it's incredibly helpful. Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. It's also a verse misused or grabbed by prosperity teachers who say, look, delight yourself in the Lord and he'll give you anything you want. So God, you know, if you just love God, he'll give you the
job, the money, the wife, all the rest. But they're not reading the first sentence or first half. Delight yourself in the Lord. If you go to God and say, Lord, look, I know I don't, but I'm
I want to love you like I should. I want to desire you. Now, you know I don't. You know I'm far more worried about my looks or my image or my reputation or my comfort or my sex life or whatever it might be. I know those are bad, though, and I really want to desire you.
Then his promise is he will give you that desire, i.e. he will give you himself.
And that means that you've got an emotional anchor, if you like. So whatever the circumstances are around you or whatever... which is basically whatever else is thrown at you, you always have him.
The 1 Timothy verse, let me just read to you, that we saw a couple of weeks ago at church. 1 Timothy 1, Paul says this, he's just praising God. He says, to the King of the ages, immortal, invisible, the only God, be honour and glory forever and ever.
Nothing can take God away from you. He's the King of the ages. Immortal, you're never going to die. He rules over everything. The only God, the one thing that can genuinely make you joyful and happy and satisfied is also the one thing that can never be taken away from you. Delight yourself in your wife, and at some point she's going to die. Delight yourself in your body image, and at some point you're going to get fat and wrinkly and old. Delight yourself in your wealth, and either you or it are going to fade. Everything will go, but the Lord will not. And he offers himself to us. And that means that I can have this deep down rooted contentment, joy, satisfaction, even if everything else goes to pot. And there's just something really grittily realistic about the Bible, I guess. It just does not promise that everything's going to go swimmingly, that your health is going to be fine and all the rest. But God does promise that this side of heaven, whilst everything else may go wrong, he will give himself to you. And so your baseline desire and your baseline prayer just needs to be, Lord, give me more of yourself. I want to desire you. I want to know you. And he will give himself to you.
It's fantastically good news. And if you are someone who is... constantly sort of tossed around in the waves of emotion, actually this will give you an anchor that is able to bring stability and joy even in the storms. I'll stop there.
Having said all that, the picture is broader in the Bible than just love God and you'll always be joyful. We've already seen Jesus loves God. He loves God more than any man ever has done. And he may have been joyful while he was doing it, but he also obviously had other emotions going on there. It wasn't just the big grin as he made a whip and drove the guys out of the temple. So really as the sort of last bit of our time together, I'll grab 2 minutes at the end just because I want to put a few caveats in about what I've said this evening, a few sort of warnings, I suppose. But for the next 10-15 minutes, whatever it is, I suggest you do this in twos or threes. Have a look at these verses. Each one has a kind of a sort of heart reaction going on in it. How a healthy Christian will feel, for want of a better word. Just dive in. What is it? Okay, just you can go through them quite quickly. Maybe split into twos and threes and sort of start either end of the list. And then again, I'd stay in twos or threes. Those questions at the bottom, which of these heart orientations most surprises you or challenges you? Which ones are you most likely to ignore? Why? Just basically, it's a bit like those exam questions, blah, 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 discuss. What jumps out at you? This is what a healthy Christian should be like. Do it in little twos and threes, and then if you finish, then you can talk back in the big groups and share your ideas. Happy?
Cool.
Too long a list, but I hope basically what you're beginning to see is that if your heart is set in the right place, it actually leads to a whole range of different sort of emotions, a lot of them are tied up with real basically they're tied up with deep down care for other people, hence you worry if they're drifting away, or you
You're angry if someone teaches them wrongly, or on and on you go. Really, what all these emotions are working out of the greatest commandment and the second greatest commandment: love God with heart, soul, mind, strength, and love your neighbour as yourself. If you really did those things, it would lead you to react emotionally, which just brings us back to the point I made last week, that your head, your heart, and your hands are all meant to be in sync. If you really did what you were told by the Bible, then you would love, and then your heart would be in the right place as well. So that they're all linked to each other. I just want to say one thing really by way of finishing. I put down final warnings, two final warnings. One is to the introvert. When you talk about the heart and about it desiring things and about how emotions are a giveaway of what you desire, there's just a danger for some people that will go into massive over-analytical mode. And almost every time we get any kind of emotion, we're sort of trying to trace it all the way back. So, you know, does this mean I'm an idolater? And you, if you're the kind of person who thinks a lot and processes a lot on, basically what I'm saying is just be a bit careful. I think it is important to examine your emotions and to think about them. But you can go too far with it, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. And the danger when you speak about the heart is that actually the people who almost don't need to hear it so much hear it far more loudly. It's a bit like preaching on the need to be committed at turning up at church. Guaranteed, the week you preach that, the people who need to hear it aren't there. And the people who are there feel really guilty, but actually they're fine. So it sort of, you know, it always goes wrong like that. So if you're a really analytical person, don't tie yourself up in knots trying to trace everything down to the last sort of heart. Ultimately, the heart, another verse, you know, from Proverbs, the heart is beyond understanding. You know, you can't search out every nook and cranny and sort it all out. So that's one thing. The second one also, if you're the kind of person who oversimplifies things, when you talk about emotions, there's a massive danger here. The heart stuff is really important and it's true. Okay, so I don't want to undermine it, anything I've said for the rest of the evening. But there is a kind of caveat, and that is that there are all sorts of other things that play in to how we feel. The list I've put down there is the list that Graham Bynon puts down. He talks about personality. You know, God has just made us differently. Some people are more naturally emotional, or more naturally expressive emotions at least, and other people are less so. It's not good, it's not bad, it's just different. So that plays into how strongly or how you feel emotions and how you express them. Your background and your upbringing. You know, some families, if you cry, you're encouraged to, you know, let it all out, express yourself. In other families, you're told to stop being a great girl's blouse and buck yourself up. You know, that is going to have an effect on you. Again, I'm not saying which one's right or wrong, or if either of them's right or wrong, but if you've had 18 years of that growing up, of course it's going to affect how you react emotionally. Your culture. If you're from a sort of stiff upper lip culture, that's one thing. If you're from a sort of, wear it on your sleeve culture, that's different as well. You know, they're... go around the world and services, you know, Sunday services look incredibly different whether you're in middle class England or, you know, plains of Africa or a house church in China. They're just cultural differences. Memories, tragically, some people have learned if they hear shouting, that sort of triggers much more fear than it does in other people, because maybe they've been through some sort of trauma as a child, or just the sort of life experiences, I suppose, can again drastically affect how we feel. And then just physical factors. I think there's probably a bit of a danger as evangelical Christians, you know, that the soul is important, the spirit is important, that we think of ourselves just as spirits who kind of live in a shell of the body, as if the body doesn't affect you. But actually, God has made us embodied spirits, physical spirits. So your literal physical body will affect how you feel. If you've had no sleep for days on end, you are going to lose your temper more quickly or get downhearted more quickly. Depression obviously has sort of physical, both symptoms and causes. Just had a baby, you know, there's all sorts of different, you know, your hormones, all sorts of things play into it, basically. And the way Graham Barnum talks about them in his book, I thought was helpful. It's not exactly that these things cause emotions or in and of themselves, but they're like a magnifying glass. They either make the emotion much, much stronger,
So, you know, you're exhausted and someone does something that normally you'd be able to, you'd get a little bit irritated with, but you'd cope with. But because you're absolutely whacked, you fly off the handle. Well, your physical body has magnified it. Or you turn the magnifying glass over and it shrinks things. And if you turn the lens the other way, things look smaller. You should be horrified at suffering. But if you've been brought up sort of brutally and have been used to seeing people abused and knocked around, then it might callous your heart to that a bit. They can reduce your emotional reaction. All of which is to say that don't be overly simplistic, either when you're thinking about your own emotional state or when you're trying to help people. The heart is still the core, the driving force. But all these other factors come into play, and it's not going to be massively loving or helpful if we just, I don't know, bowl up to the person who's depressed and say, "What do you mean you're depressed? Jesus died for you on the cross. Rejoice." It just doesn't work like that. Okay, it's not going to help either if we just say, "Oh, you're probably just tired." There is a spiritual aspect to us. The heart is always involved, but we can't just reduce things to one factor. Good. We started late, so I'm going to give ourselves another 5 minutes. Just spend a few minutes at the end. Let's pray either in the pairs or in the groups or whatever. Pray for some of the reactions you've seen that perhaps you don't have. Pray for healthy hearts. Pray for a desire for God. Plenty to pray for.